There's a certain sound to the American South, a hush, a hymn, blue notes soft in the night air. But to really hear the South, you have to listen with more than your ears. You have to listen with your memory, your pain, your longing, and your joy. Today, Salvation South follows the journey of a man who taught us how to listen to the South, Dr. William Reynolds Ferris, known to his friends as Bill.
I grew up on a farm outside of Vicksburg in Warren County, Mississippi, and we were the only white family there for several miles. And all my friends, his childhood friends, and my world was surrounded with black families and children my age. And I used to go to a little black church on the farm every first Sunday when they had a service with a lady named Mary Gordon. And I learned to sing the hymns and to love the sermons.
Rose Hill Church was tiny and had services only once a month, but it was a safe gathering place for the community.
And as I grew older, I realized there were no hymnals in that church, and that when those families were gone, the music would disappear. And so I decided to record the music and photograph it and later film it as a way of preserving that beautiful world that was my earliest experience with black music, and incredibly intimate and powerful.
He began that work when he was only 12 years old in 1954 with a camera and a tape recorder. Later, he got his hands on a Super 8 movie camera and started filming.
In a way, it was the foundation for my entire life as a folklorist.
And what a rich and generous life it has been. Bill Ferris is now 83 years old. Over his life, he has taught thousands of students to study their home, the American South, to see it as it is, not as they want it to be. To tell the stories of all its people as they really are, not as characters in some Moonlight and Magnolias fiction or mythology. And to listen to it.
Won't be long, one of these days, won't be long.
Welcome to another edition of Salvation South Deluxe. For 50 years, Bill Ferris's work has done more than document the South. It has dignified the South. He showed the whole world the truth, beauty, and struggle that echo in the stories, the songs, and even the prayers of Southerners, regardless of their skin color or background. I'm Chuck Reese, your host. Salvation South Deluxe is a monthly series of in-depth pieces that we add to our regular podcast feed. Here, we try to shine the light on untold stories of the Southern experience and let you hear our region's truly authentic voices. And today, thanks to many decades of Bill Ferris's work, we have a rich abundance of those voices we can share with you. At Salvation South, our mission is to tell the many and varied stories of the American South, of hardship, of triumph, of faith and family, everything about this region. But to always tell them as truthfully as we can, to show the full measure of who we are and who we hope to become. No one has blazed the trail we walk quite like Bill Ferris. Let me take a couple of minutes to walk you through how he blazed it. Bill found his calling when he was in his teens, filming, photographing, and recording in the Mississippi Delta. But through the years he spent earning his bachelor's and master's degrees, his professors and advisors kept telling him that following his calling just didn't fit into any of the standard academic paths. Frustrated, he took a year away from his master's studies at Northwestern University to go to Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. And this was late 1965 through early 1966.
I spent a year at Trinity College in Dublin on a Rotary Foundation fellowship working on James Joyce. But I wanted to study the oral voices, and I kept running into walls at Northwestern. They said, those musics that you're recording, that's not literature in terms of what we teach.
But while he was in Ireland, he met a professor of folklore from Ohio State University.
I complained to him that English was too narrow. It wouldn't allow the oral literature to be studied in the same way that we looked at Shakespeare and Joyce. And he smiled and he said, well, you simply need to be in folklore. And I said, what's that?
Although Bill had been doing what folklorists do for a decade, he had never heard the word.
And he said, well, there's several PhD programs. And he basically opened the door to my graduate study at the University of Pennsylvania, where I went and met with my advisor, Kenneth Goldstein.
Goldstein, by then, had spent a decade roaming North America and the British Isles recording folk singers. In America, he had recorded Leadbelly and Lightnin' Hopkins. In Ireland, the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. Kenneth Goldstein was a major influence on the folk music revival of the 50s and 60s that spawned Bob Dylan and other artists like him. Bill Ferris says his first meeting with Kenneth Goldstein was one of the best days of his life.
I brought a box of recordings and photographs in at that first meeting and put them on his desk. And I said, Dr. Goldstein, this is what I have been doing. Can I do that here? He smiled and he said, that, my boy, will be your dissertation. Keep doing it. Well, that was the most wonderful moment of my life.
After he finished his doctorate at Penn, he took his first teaching job at Jackson State University, the historically black college in Mississippi's capital city. By then, it was the early 1970s. In Connecticut, Yale University was on the verge of launching the first graduate program in African American studies in the Ivy League, and Ferris soon got an invite to join that faculty. And that box of recordings and photographs? Well, of course, he took that to New Haven with him. The university at that time was also in the middle of building the Yale University Media Design Center, which was meant to be the film production counterpart of the Yale University Press, which had published the books of Yale faculty since 1908.
The studio produced films, and they approached me because they knew I was a filmmaker and said, we'd like to film your course on black folklore. And I was thrilled, and we got the support, and the team began to work. They filmed my lectures. We brought in B.B. King to perform and speak, and James Thomas. We filmed in Harlem, in New Haven, and then I took a crew to the Mississippi Delta for a week. And that was powerful, radical material. We got an honorary doctorate of humane letters at Yale awarded to B.B. King. So these were sort of foundational steps that shook the foundations of the traditional academic world.
With the Media Design Center, Bill took the footage he had shot and the recordings he had made for the previous two decades, combined them with new footage that they captured, and then transformed all of it into four separate documentary films, about a half an hour each. All four of them were released at the same time in 1975, when Ferris was 33 years old. Each one covered a different facet of black life in Mississippi. The first focused on the blues, and it featured the late, great B.B. King. It was called Give My Poor Heart Ease. Watching that film today, 50 years on, you can see a younger Bill Ferris's journey to understand a uniquely Southern and uniquely black art form, blues music.
This is B.B. King, making a statement and a natural fact. All you gotta do is sit back and dig where it's coming from. Listen, not only with your ear, but with your heart.
You follow his camera as he goes to the sources, front porches.
You can get the blues by the woman. Go kiss and hug and won't see her till 3-4 night looking for her, you get the blues there.
Cute joints.
About a little something you heard.
Mississippi's infamous state penitentiary, Parchman Farm.
When you're working and you're singing, it makes you get your mind off of everything else and get it on your way.
And inside a Manhattan hotel room with B.B. King, who was at that very moment writing the biggest radio hit of his career, The Thrill Is Gone.
Everything leads me back to the feeling of the blues, or the feeling that I get from playing or singing the blues or hearing others singing play it. In fact, I think life itself is the blues.
The second film released that year by Ferris focused on the black church, and it combined the black and white footage Bill had shot at Rose Hill Church back in the Delta with new color film he shot at St. James's Church in New Haven. That church's congregation was made up of black Southerners who had fled Jim Crow and moved northward in the Great Migration. The film was called Two Black Churches. The third focused on black artists and artisans in Mississippi, from home builders and quilters to painters and sculptors. That film was called Made in Mississippi. And the final film in the set focused on black storytellers from Ferris's home state, whose stories ran from the hilarious to the somber and from the sacred to the profane. It was called I Ain't Lying. For the 50th anniversary of these films, Salvation South, the magazine I edit, has revisited all of them. We've shown our online readers all four movies start to finish, and I have interviewed Bill about each one, asking him to recall their making and to reflect on what they mean today, a half century later. After this short break, we'll be back to give you a taste. You're listening to Salvation South Deluxe.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
In Bill Ferris's documentary, Two Black Churches, we see the contrast between Rose Hill Church in the Mississippi Delta of the 1960s and St. James's Church in the city of New Haven, Connecticut in the 1970s. The film opens with black and white footage of Rose Hill's members marching toward a pond for a baptismal service, singing a slow a cappella hymn. Then the movie jumps into the 1970s in full color, into the forceful choral music of St. James's Church in Connecticut, accompanied by piano and drums. The contrast in styles is apparent, but what you see more clearly is what the congregations share.
The dress at both churches is elegant, colorful, beautiful. And the hymns, there's no question that the St. James's service with its elaborate choir and music is also, if you were to ask, quite familiar with the traditional hymns and spirituals that would be sung in the rural Southern churches like Rose Hill. So there's a continuum, and the roots of Black religion are deep in both churches. They are rooted in rural Southern worlds that can be felt in both services, but they're also quite different.
The most important point the film makes is how important the church has been throughout the history of Black America, because the space is sacred and inviolate. The churches are mighty fortresses against the physical violence of Jim Crow and the hatred and prejudice outside their doors.
What I love about one whom the blood has been applied, he has a telephone, and when trouble arises, he can call on his gold. What I love about him, the line is never busy. You can call in the morning, and you can call at high 12.
Since I was a child, I have always felt privileged to be allowed into those spaces. The church is a safe haven for Black families. The Black church is. These are Black spaces owned and controlled by Black families.
In Made in Mississippi, the artwork of everyday survival takes center stage. Quilt makers, sculptors, blacksmiths. And importantly, we learn how these art forms and skills are passed down through the generations.
Oh, and sometimes when all the women used to be together, they be quilting at night, have little lights to sit all over the quilt.
Little tin lamp.
Now everybody would sit around, and then when they couldn't see how to thread the needle, they would get the children to come in, thread and needle for them, and then after a while they'd get up and go to eating and drinking, maybe have a little wine, and everybody feel good and start to go back quilting again.
There's a Mississippi quilt maker who became a central character in Ferris's earliest documentary projects. Her name was Pecolia Warner, and she called it fireplace learning.
And you, mm-hmm. how you make your little block about right there, and sew them on and on, and then you have your quilt.
Fireplace learning was a powerful way of sharing and preserving knowledge that goes back in every generation to Africa for thousands of years. Our first knowledge was oral, and in the Black community, it has a deep and sacred kind of value.
The beauty is functional, and the function is beautiful. The stuff of life preserved in fiber and fire, reflecting the spirit of a people who, despite facing horrendous oppression, created beauty. You also see a deep level of community in the creation, how the people of a certain place supported each other and held each other up.
There is a sense of community and shared knowledge and shared responsibility. If you kill a hog, the whole community comes and they help and they share the meat with each other. If you make a quilt, you will often give it to a neighbor who needs a quilt. To me, film is essential because all too often when we see a quilt in a museum or a work of folk art, it's labeled as anonymous. The creator is not remembered. But in the film, we cannot forget the voices of people who made the quilt or sculpted the skull or face or built the house. I give the maker a lot of credit because they're like the master storyteller or the consummate gospel singer who leads the choir. They are recognized in the community as the most gifted at what they do.
Ferris's fourth film from 1975, I Ain't Lying, is a testament to the determination that lived in Mississippi's rural black communities, even in the early 70s, when white Southerners were still desperately trying to ostracize and discriminate against them, despite the passage of the Civil and Voting Rights Acts. Many years ago, an old man in Appalachia told me, "Son, never let the truth get in the way of a good story." And it's clear, and I ain't lying, that Ferris had made friends with some master storytellers, people who understood the freedom they could find in telling their own stories their own way.
We really tried to pick the best of a broad range of oral tradition, from the classic animal stories, animal tales like Brer Wolf, Brer Rabbit, that are African in origin. And many of these are trickster tales where a weaker adversary uses their head to outwit a stronger adversary.
This is James Sunford Thomas, a blues musician who also appears in Give My Poor Heart Ease, and he tells the story that opens I Ain't Lying.
A lady was going to be baptized, and the preacher is an old-timer. The preacher, they got together, and all of them went down to the creek. You know, they used to baptize in the creek. Now they baptize the church, have a pool. But at that time, they all were baptized in the creeks and rivers, you know. And so they had them baptized two or three. And this lady, she saw an alligator out behind her, the preacher. And the preacher said, "Come on, sister, to the water and be baptized." Said, "No, I don't like that thing behind you." Said, "Don't let the devil fool you. Come on and be baptized. It's your only time to be saved." "I don't like that thing behind you." So the preacher said, "Don't let the devil fool you." He said, "Come on down to the water and be baptized. I just don't like that thing behind you." So she finally come on down to the water, and she looked and saw him again. And she said, "I just don't like that thing behind you." And so the preacher looked back. He said, "No, by God, and I don't either."
The sense of humor is really finely honed, because the way it integrates, you know, a very familiar image from Scripture, the idea of "get thee behind me, Satan," you know, and this woman sees the alligator, but the preacher who's about to baptize her doesn't. And so every time she says, "I don't like that thing behind you," it plays off that bit from Scripture until the surprise comes at the end of the story.
It's true. And I think there's a kind of sheer beauty of the voice in each of these stories. While a story is a powerful focusing device, they all are sort of like a chorus, old and young. These voices have a lyrical quality. There's a sense of beauty about the entire fabric of all of these stories woven together in the film. You can just go through the film in that way and just enjoy the power of these voices. And each of them is telling a dramatic story, but together they're really almost like a symphony.
These stories really are bridges. They teach us not just how black Southerners endured, but how they triumphed through wit, faith, and endless invention. It has been a tremendous pleasure for me over the last several months to ask Bill Ferris questions about these films. And I think if Bill Ferris had never made another film, had never conducted an interview, had never taught another class, those films alone would stand in tribute to a life well lived. But there's more, much more. In the late 1970s, Ferris left Yale and came south again. In 1978, he became the founding director of the first graduate program in Southern Studies at any American university, the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi in Oxford. Today, Southern students can study the region that shaped them, for better or worse, at many universities around the South. And arguably, Bill Ferris deserves a lion's share of the credit for that. In the 20 years he remained in Oxford, Ferris, his faculty members, and their students gathered thousands of photographs, field recordings, and films. The center became a hub for multidisciplinary research and teaching on Southern history and literature, music, and folk life, and social relations. In 1989, I was living in New York and spending more time every day trying to make sense of the region that I loved and had left. And that was the year when a very large book, almost 2,000 pages, appeared in bookstores. It was called The Encyclopedia of Southern Culture, and its co-editors were Bill Ferris and his colleague at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture, Charles Wilson Reagan. And that book, that encyclopedia, defined the field of Southern studies, and it sold more than 1 million copies. And it lit a fire inside me. I came home to Georgia, first working in journalism and then in politics and finally in corporate communications. But the fire kept getting bigger until I finally realized about a dozen years ago that making a place for Southern stories was my calling. I am hardly alone. It would be easy to find hundreds, if not thousands, of others, former students of Ferris or people simply inspired by his work, who would tell you the same thing. So to spend this summer as I have, frequently in conversation with Bill Ferris, it's been eye-opening. As a result, I think I now understand the driving force behind Bill's lifetime of work.
From childhood on and teenage years on, recording and preserving music and voice the stories of first the community on the farm where I grew up, and then later all over the Mississippi Delta and other areas, I saw it as a work of protest where the voices of Black families had been omitted from the books and the records historically that we were taught in school. I saw these voices and recording them as a political act. It was not marching in civil rights marches, but it was in many ways to me just as important. Because without those recordings, the voices would be forgotten. Anytime you document and show respect for and preserve the Black experience, that's a political act.
Right.
Because many people would prefer to see it erased from our history. And we're doing the opposite. We're etching a mark on the face of oblivion for the Black voice, the Black face, and the Black tradition culturally.
In 1997, President Bill Clinton called upon Ferris to head the National Endowment for the Humanities. For 4 years, he worked to spread the gospel of documentation and preservation of local folkways across the entire nation, not just the South. When Clinton left office in 2001, Ferris became the Senior Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Today, he is retired, still living in Chapel Hill, and still deeply involved in the work of encouraging young people to collect the stories of their ancestors and, by so doing, honor them.
Technology has made every man a potential filmmaker and documenter of his or her world. And so I tell my students, you have no excuse, and start with your grandparents and parents. Record their memories, so for your grandchildren, you'll have a treasure to pass along to them.
In a decade of knowing Bill, and recently working more closely with him, I have come to know a special person. He is, and I say this with no cheese whatsoever, one of the most considerate and polite people I have ever known. He waves no flags and meets out no harsh words, but his work, make no mistake, is radical. Radical because it makes the everyday sacred. Radical because it makes overlooked people unforgettable. Radical because it reveals the extraordinary spirits that live within ordinary people, ordinary Southerners. At Salvation South, we try our best to follow in his footsteps. We can tell the South's hardest stories, its most beautiful ones, and every kind of story in between, because Bill Ferris blazed that trail for us. Bill, this episode and Salvation South's entire 50 years of Ferris Project is for you. We'll never be able to show gratitude that is in any way equal to the time and patience you have offered us over this year. We have a long list of people who have been helpful as we have assembled the materials for this project. They are too numerous to mention here, but we must shout out all the good people in the Special Collections Unit of the Wilson Library on the University of North Carolina campus, which houses the vast archive of work from Bill's career. Visit SalvationSouth.com right now, where you can watch my complete interviews with Dr. Ferris about each of these four extraordinary films. You can also watch all four of the 1975 documentaries from start to finish, so don't miss your chance to see the faces and hear the voices of the people we've been talking about. You've been listening to Salvation South Deluxe, proudly produced in cooperation with Georgia Public Broadcasting and its network of 20 stations around our state. Every Wednesday, we add a new 3-minute commentary about Southern stuff to our podcast feed. And every month, we add longer deluxe stories such as the one we've just told you. I'm Chuck Reese, your host and the editor-in-chief of Salvation South, which you can find 24/7 at SalvationSouth.com. Our producer is the mighty Jake Cook, who also composed our theme music. GPB's director of podcasts is Jeremy Powell. And none of this could ever happen without the support of GPB's Sandy Malcolm, Adam Woodleaf, and Bert Wesley Huffman. We'll be back next month with another full-length episode of the Salvation South podcast.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.